Today, we're going to talk about something that gets talked about a lot in world relations, and that's Starbucks and all the impact that that campaign has had for the last couple years on creating all kinds of opportunities, both for Starbucks and many other employers to respond to. It seems like there's never a day where you can't find something to bring up related to that topic. So Phil and I are going to chat with one of our favorite labor lawyers, John Hyman. John, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Glad you were able to join us. You and I have done a podcast, audio podcast elsewhere, where we spent a lot of time between talking amongst ourselves about Starbucks over these last couple of years. And we've been pretty consistent in going through and saying, yeah, Starbucks is probably never going to give a contract to the Starbucks Workers United. Why would they? Well, that seems to have taken a big shift here. They've engaged in a couple rounds of negotiations. They've stated they want to reach an agreement. And so I guess we'll start with whether you think, John, whether we need to retract our prediction and maybe make a secondary pick, or what's your take on it?
I say go big or go home. I'm going to stick with my original prediction, despite all the tea leaves that might point otherwise. No, the reality is that there will probably be contracts. Starbucks management ownership at the corporate level has clearly signaled a shift in their tone towards their employees and the union. And all indications are that they're going to keep meeting, bargaining, and working towards contracts. And I think it might take a while, but I think that they will get those contracts eventually.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's up to the SEIU. Previously, I would have said Starbucks is unlikely to agree to a contract. And I think what the transition that's happened has totally changed that. I think Starbucks would like to get a contract, stop spending all this money on legal fees, and put this as far behind them as they can. The SEIU is going to have to achieve a deal. And that's the
part. Yeah, it does. It certainly does take two sides to bargain, right? And so I suppose the SEIU could dig their heels in and say, you know, we're going to shoot for the moon, and we're not going to agree to anything until you give us that moon.
SEIU wants a contract.
They might do that. And they might do that. I think they probably do want a contract, though. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Starbucks piece is interesting because they did spend, I don't know, tens of millions of dollars in legal fees. $250 million, I think, was a number. One of the numbers I saw floated around, a ridiculous amount in legal fees. They took a massive PR hit as a result of their opposition to organizing. And their shareholders, a good sized tranche of their shareholders, had enough. And the change in management clearly has signaled a different tone. And so there is certainly a willingness on that side of the table to get a deal done. If the SEIU is doing what they're supposed to do, they should want to get a deal done for their members as well. The cynic in me says, you know, maybe they have another agenda they're trying to push here, and maybe their members aren't their prime agenda here. So
I agree with that, but I do think their prime agenda is get this deal to be able to trumpet to the world that they got a deal. And that's why I do think there will be a deal. I don't think it's going to be anything. I think because of that, I don't think it's going to be anything dramatic, but it doesn't really have to be. Like Michael brought up just a second ago. I mean, they got just cause. I've been making the argument. I would love to hear your comment on this, but I've been telling clients for a couple of years, why wouldn't you just give just cause, get rid of the at will clause in your handbook and just put.
I agree with you 100%. I'm not sure I would. The reality is, and I a bunch of years ago at my blog, the Ohio Employer Law blog, I wrote an obituary for employment at will. That was the name of the post. And the point was, there's so many exceptions to employment at will now. Anti-retaliation.
It doesn't really exist.
It doesn't exist anymore. And so I would never, if a client came to me and said, I want to fire an employee. All right, so Where's the paper trail? Well, there was no paper trail. Why do you want to get rid of them? Models don't like them. I mean, don't, no, you can't do that. Like, you need to have the paper trail. You need to have the reason. You got to have documentation. You need some, you know, some level of progressive discipline, so that the employees not feeling ambushed, because employees that feel ambushed run off to their, you know, friendly neighborhood plaintiff's side employment lawyer. And that's how lawsuits get started. So,
and you got to be able to bend that lawsuit, right? Like, even if you are at will and that's the presumption, it's like, if they say it was illegal termination, you better be able to defend that case, or you're spending a bunch of money in legal fees and probably damages.
Yeah, judges and especially juries. Mm-hmm. Well, without the paper trail, you're going to get to a jury. No judge is going to grant you a summary judgment. And juries like paper. They want to see the paper trail. They want to see the documentation. They want to know that the employee had notice and that there was an opportunity to fix deficiencies and all the, you know, and all the things that, you know, we think of when it goes into this idea of just cause that we build in under, you know, union contracts. And without that, you're putting people like me in an impossible position to defend that termination in a lawsuit. And I don't counsel businesses to fire without just cause. So, I agree with you. It's an easy give. Businesses still don't like giving it when they don't have to.
Well, and back to Starbucks, I feel like this agreement is probably going to be mostly Me Too. Like, it's not like Starbucks was some horrible employer before, notwithstanding like the whole PR campaign. Like, that, you know, they provide great pay benefits for the jobs that they offer. They were considered sort of top of the heap before this whole thing started. I think the natural sort of end zone for a situation like this is they're going to get an agreement that's pretty much what most Starbucks workers already have. And there'll be a handful of things that will be a little bit different, like just cause, that will be trumpeted. And they'll say, these workers have it guaranteed in writing, the non-represented ones don't. And like, that will be the giant win. And that's what they need to kind of really, you know, first of all, get dues money flowing. And then also be able to then trumpet to the rest of the world, like, look, this is a good thing, and you should sign up too.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the union has already won the PR war here, mm-hmm. but I think you're right. I think they do need a win at the bargaining table to take the next step, which is the and it was worth it, right? Yeah. And all these employees losing their jobs and, you know, all of the time we spent organizing and all the time we spent at the table, and I, it was all worth it to get this for these workers. I think you're right.
Well, and the other thing that's happening kind of under the hood is, like, in the last week or so, last 10 days, maybe there have been like an additional 20-ish Starbucks that have filed petitions, right? So like, this is still like, this isn't going away, right? So Starbucks is like literally morphing into a partially unionized company, and if they get an agreement, they're going to see more of that. I mean, that's like an inevitable concession. Phil, you had a take on this for a long time about the whole campaign that SEIU and Workers United, or whichever group you want to talk about by name, they were kind of like the dog that caught the car, that they mm-hmm. didn't know what to do with this, and I guess now we're finally starting to see where they're, to your point, where they want to land some sort of a win. Yeah, it doesn't have to be a home run, maybe.
Yeah. But I mean, turns out, like, I mean, my comment at the beginning of all this, or as it was going, was like, you know, they didn't whiteboard, you know, 500 stores organized when they were launching this campaign. But it happened. And then it became sort of like this World War III. You know, it didn't really look, it looked for a while like they weren't really going to get anywhere. They weren't going to get an agreement. It was just going to be swamped in litigation forever. And there has been, you know, a fair amount of that. We'll be talking about one of the cases in a minute, but, but it really worked out. You know, I don't think they could have planned it the way that it's worked out. It probably couldn't have worked out better for them. Like they have achieved, getting Starbucks to the table. Starbucks is playing nice in the media and it looks like at the table, like they've made some major concessions on things like even if it's not going to be a national contract, it will be a pattern agreement that will apply at basically every store. They're allowing hundreds of people to participate in the bargaining. So they've given in on a lot of things that I think a lot of employers wouldn't have. And those are all big wins for the SEIU.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And in fact, let's switch over to that case. So this is the dance, right? In that Starbucks has compromised and started to try to make, you know, some sort of arrangements or peace deal or whatever you want to call it, but they haven't abandoned every one of their efforts. And they had a very significant case in front of the Supreme Court over the firing of a number of employees at a store in, where was it, Philadelphia? Memphis 7. Sorry, that was blanking out. Yeah. So, and that decision just came down yesterday. So you want to kind of set that up for us and talk about that for a minute?
Well, John, why don't you give us the...
Yeah. So, I mean, the case dealt with, like, what's the standard for the board to get injunctive relief under Section 10J of the National Labor Relations Act. And there was a big split among the circuits as to what the standard is for injunctive relief. Is it kind of reasonable cause that the act has been violated, or should courts apply the traditional injunctive standards that we apply in every piece of civil litigation, like success on the merits, or the likelihood of success on the merits, irreparable injury, harm to the public, public interest, et cetera.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court said an injunction is an injunction, and there is nothing in the act that would suggest that we should deviate from the same four factors that we apply in every case that we consider injunctive relief, and that the circuits, including the Sixth Circuit, where that case came from, that apply the reasonable cause standard are applying the wrong standard, and they should apply the same four-factor analysis that every court does in every other, or that is applied in every other instance when a litigant comes into court seeking injunctive relief. So on paper, it looks like a win for employers. I know, Phil, you, I think, had a thought that this probably might not be the win that maybe some of the talking heads are saying it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my comment's been it's a Seinfeld episode, right? It's a decision about nothing. It was, it is marginally now harder in some circuits. So, like, in half the circuits ish, the general counsel had to meet this same four factor burden anyway, and brings injunctions all the time and wins injunctions in those jurisdictions. So that's the law about half the places. Now it's the law every place. But that's really basically all this case decided. This exact case, the Memphis 7 case, is going back to district court, where the district court will use the four factors instead of the reasonable test and will probably issue an injunction. I mean,
probably. I doubt district court's going to change their mind,
right?
in terms of their result.
They didn't like the facts the first time. I think they'll probably figure out a way to say, you're likely to succeed. This is irreparable harm. I don't think this decision is going to be any different. I think the Supreme Court made the right decision. I thought it was really interesting. It was a 9-0. Ketanji Brown's, kind of concurred in the result, but not like, still feels like the board deserves more deference than the other eight justices were giving them. But other than that, like I said, it's really, it's not that big of a change. And I don't think it really practically changes anything on the ground in terms of employers shouldn't change their behavior. Don't discriminate against employees exercising their sexual
Don't stuff. Fire organizing workers.
Yeah. The general counsel is still going to seek injunctions, probably in exactly all the same cases that they seek them now. My big thing is I wish that they would... So going back to irreparable harm, and I will say that point is really important in a lot of these 10J cases, because the general counsel sits around on these cases for like a year or more and doesn't immediately go in and seek an injunction. And there are district courts that will look at that and go, look, you already have a case in front of an ALJ who is doing all investigating all the actual facts of what happened and making credibility determinations. And that's the place where this should be decided, not here at district court in like a rapid review that doesn't have discovery and so on.
Yep. And I just finished I'm in the middle of litigating a case. The case didn't end, but the plaintiff went in seeking an injunction on a non-compete, but they waited like 11 months to go into court and file. And I got to stand up in front of the judge, common pleas judge here in Cuyahoga County, Ohio, and be like, where's the fire drill? Like, they've known about this for 11 months, and now they come into court seeking an emergency order that this is some emergency relief they need to stop some glaring irreparable harm. They've known about it for 11 months. Mm-hmm. So whatever irreparable harm existed to create this emergency 11 months ago, it doesn't exist anymore. So what are we doing here?
Right. Exactly. And district court judges, I mean, it obviously depends on who you're in front of, but that they do look at that and go, is this really like an emergency? Why are we wasting our time here? Just go prove your case to the judge that's actually like hearing all the facts and deciding this thing, and let them decide it.
Yeah. The other piece of the irreparable injury prong of that test is that courts have said forever that if money damages can remedy the harm, you don't really have an irreparable injury. Mm-hmm. And so here you have 7 fired employees. Right. They're owed some back pay. Looks like a money damages that if I'm Starbucks, that's my argument. Like, this is a money damages case. There's nothing irreparable here. And the union will argue, the irreparable injury isn't to those 7, but it's to all the other workers who now are fearful for their jobs, and we need to protect their jobs. And, mm-hmm. You're trying to, intimidate them and force them to do things that they would otherwise not do if left to their free choice. And so there's countervailing arguments, but on its face, when you're dealing with a fired employee that lost some pay, the damages look like money damages to me, which courts always say is not irreparable injury. So.
Yeah. But even in that argument, like, the store unionized, it's like, even if you're saying it like somehow squelched, Section 7 rights or chilled the exercise of the rights, like, they exercised them. There's no even harm there.
There were some really weird facts on that case too. Like, I didn't read the case recently, but as I recall, they invited the press into the store like after hours or something. There was like quite a lot of weird circumstance in this whole thing as well. This is not the only. Go ahead.
Sorry to belabor this, but like if you go to the ALJ decision, the facts were not fantastic for Starbucks in this. There were lots of exceptions made to like after hours access to stores.
Yeah.
So when I first read the ALJ decision, I was like, I'm not sure they really want to like go to war over this. And then going back to what we originally were talking about, one of the things I thought was interesting, the SEIU came out and was like, why did Starbucks should have like withdrawn this case? Why did they let this go all the way to a Supreme Court decision? We're supposedly like working together on things, and yet they're continuing to these legal battles. And I think, that is an interesting point. I'm glad that they did it, and I'm glad that this issue is settled, but it's an interesting point.
Yeah, like I said, part of the dance, I guess. You don't give up everything just because you want to compromise or reach an agreement, right? Some things you have, I mean, I don't know what the reasons are, but for some, they must have some, because you don't go to the Supreme Court on a whim, generally speaking. So this is not the only case, the only employer that had, so there was we don't need to get into too deeply in the weeds on this other case, but there was an Amazon case where they had been, where the ALJ had issued a broad cease and desist order, and that was thrown out. And then there's like a trend, there are other decisions pending in front of the Supreme Court related to the Chevron doctrine. So unions are enjoying organizing success, wins, et cetera. And the courts at various levels, but especially the Supreme Court, seems to be more pro-business. So I'm kind of curious, is this a pushback against the NLRB? Is the law changing? Like, where do you guys think this is all going to shake out with these kind of conflicting pressures in the legal system?
Well, the Chevron piece is probably the least publicized case that could most significantly change the way our government works. Mm-hmm. Chevron has been the law of the land for 40 years. In a nutshell, the Chevron decision said that if a federal agency, if Congress expressly speaks on an issue, that closes. That's the end of the story. If Congress hasn't expressly spoke through a law, if an agency's interpretation of a law is kind of reasonably grounded in the law, then the agency's interpretation can stand. And that is now being challenged, not in an employment case, but it's in a case involving, I think, environmental regulations. But all the tea leaves point to Chevron deference, at being the deference to an administrative agency's interpretation of a statute through its own regulations, as going away. And that is going to significantly change how every federal agency works. It's going to change how the NLRB interprets the National Labor Relations Act on, you know, a variety of issues, from, you know, how it interprets, you know, protected concerted activity, to, you know, organizing rules and election rules. And it could potentially change, you know, fundamentally the relationship, or how we understand currently the relationship between unions and employers. It could change, you know, how the Department of Labor issues like wage and hour regulations, how OSHA regulates through OSHA standards. How the EEOC interprets, regulation just came out interpreting the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. People have issues with that because it says, you know, employers have to, you know, give employees time off for like abortions or fertility treatments. And so people are up in arms over that. And this decision could throw out those regulations. So it really is, it's if the decision comes down the way a lot of us think it's going to come down, it's going to be paradigm shifting for how federal agencies do their business.
And it's interesting, you know, DOL just took out of a couple of briefs arguments around Chevron deference. Like I think they're assuming the sale. Like I think they already like know this argument's going away, and they're just like, they're taking it, you know, they're taking it out. I also thought it was interesting. This isn't exactly Chevron, but I think it's the same basic idea. The SEIU came out yesterday, I think, and asked the NLRB to stop its joint employer rulemaking, like stop defending mm-hmm. employer rulemaking, let it go away, and just do this through decisional decisions versus rulemaking. And I think a big part of that is this same idea of, look, the circuit courts, when they get a hold of this stuff, you know, they're going to make law that we're going to be stuck with. And here I'm speaking for sort of the labor side. They're going to make law that we're going to be stuck with for a long time that we're not going to like. And I've been making that same argument for a while. Like, you can try to push the National Labor Relations Act, you know, as far as you want to, but once the circuit courts get a hold of it, you know, it's not just they go, oh, we disagree with you. It's like, no, here's the law going forward, and it's the opposite of what you wanted.
So buyer beware, maybe a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is a little bit the law of unintended consequences, right? Mm-hmm. That, I mean, that the lack of deference is going to cut both ways, depending on how the winds blow at the agency in any given administration. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. Let's pivot to one more labor issue, or it's not really an issue, labor topic, I guess. So John's a labor lawyer. He's also a beer lawyer, which some others amongst us enjoy that topic as well from time to time.
Hey, beer needs great representation. So beer,
yes, so, and lawyers need great beer. So it definitely works both ways. The world needs both.
Professionals respecting each other's professions. So anyway, the story came out late last week. The guy who owns Chobani, who's a billionaire apparently from owning Chobani, has decided to go and buy the assets of the Anchor Brewing Company, which is a 120 some year old brewer that unionized a few years ago and went out of business last year due to financial crisis. And he announced that he was going to resurrect the brand and bring it back. And so immediately the union members, I think there were 39 of them, stood up and said, great, we can't wait to get our jobs back. And so, but it doesn't really work that way in this situation, because I understand this was an asset purchase, at least based on what I read in the in one article that I saw from the San Francisco area where their anchor is had been based. So you guys want to talk about asset purchase versus, you know, and what happens with it with a successors and all that sort of stuff?
Yes. And I, everything I've read suggests this was an asset purchase, and I have no idea why the buyer would have acquired this in any other way. I don't know why you would have bought the stock of a closed company. That makes zero sense to me. So you have this closed up brewery, you have all their equipment that's sitting there, you have their, all their, you know, all their IP, their trademarks and, you know, and the like. And so, I mean, that's what you buy, and there's no reason. I can't imagine anyone would have advised Chobani guy to buy this as a stock sale. If it was a stock sale, the question, the answer is easy. The union and the collective bargaining agreement go right along with, and the new owner just steps into the shoes of the old company as if nothing changes. In an asset deal, I mean, it's really going to depend in large part on how the, which employees are hired. And if there's a majority, if there is, if a majority of the current workforce is made up of employees of the old employer, then there's going to be a presumption that that a majority of the current workforce supported the union the same as the old employer, the same as they did with Anchor Steam, you know, version one. There's going to be a really good argument for the union to make that Anchor Steam version two should recognize the union and you know, and move forward with that union in place.
Well, we make some amazing beer in Oklahoma. And so my advice to Chobani would be to move the equipment.
Get out of San Francisco.
Don't hire, you know, the folks that are in San Francisco, and then you're in good shape. But a lot of people think that, oh, wow, you're going to reopen the company and it was unionized. And so like it's automatically unionized. And yeah, as you just said, like that's not typically how it works, because most of the time it's an asset sale. And then it becomes this whole issue of, you know, do you rehire the employee complement from the prior company? But that's the it's a little in the weeds, but like it's an interesting point. And a lot of employees that are voting in unions right now, you know, don't get like any of this stuff. They're you know, and you know, everyone gets real mad when you try to explain like, hey, here's how the law works. But like, you really should understand how the law works before you decide you're going to pay money, you know, for representation, and it's going to take you years to get an agreement, and the agreement might not be any different or better than what you have now, and could even be worse, and like all that stuff never really gets explained, and you just get to figure it out the hard way.
Yeah, and by the way, the employer could decide just to close up shop, sell its assets to someone else who might decide to reopen it and not hire you, and now business A is now business B, but business B, you don't have a job with business B, and you all that time and money you spent was for naught. So
yeah. Right.
Well, and you know, in the School of Hard Knocks piece, you know, I've been through many times in my HR career where we've closed unionized facilities or non-unionized facilities. And there are certain things that you're obligated to do in those circumstances, but it really depends on what's in the contract. And most labor agreements don't have, you know, 100% prohibition against transferring work or closing a plant down. And unions really don't have a lot of ability to prevent that in most cases. They can negotiate for severance, they can negotiate for decision, you know, but it doesn't, they have a hard time preventing a business that wants to shut a location down from doing so. Yeah. Most people think they can, but they really can't.
Yeah. I do feel like it's important to just make crystal clear, it is illegal for a company to, you know, close down a business and try to like reopen it non-union somewhere else, and or to refuse to hire people that used to work in a unionized business to try to keep it non-union. So there are a lot of rules around, you know, around this whole, you know, and they're there for very good reason. Like it should not be a thing that you shut down a business for the sole purpose of like getting rid of a union.
Yeah, and that's not at all what I meant. We were making pure, you know, business decisions based on economics or, you know, whatever, without union animus, right? That I mean, that that's super important that that be the decision be made in that context.
But the flip side of that is the general counsel is asking to like reopen stores that would have like that were closed down for economic reasons and would have been closed down anyway, and those stores should not be reopened like that. Like an employer has a right, a clear right, and by the way, an employer has a right to shut down a store because they hate the union that's there. Like they it's not, as long as they're not like reopening the business or like trying to reopen, you know, there's clear case law that like you don't, if your reason is because you don't like the union, like you can, as long as you're actually going out of business, like you can do that.
Right. Because the board can't really force you to operate a business against your will. Right. I mean, in most cases.
Yeah.
So John, before we move on to a couple other things, is there, I know it's been kind of up and down in your labor side of your beer practice, but is there anything else going on that's interesting or hot right now, or has it kind of cooled off in that sector?
You know, it's never, what's interesting is that when all of the organizing was going on nationwide over the last 2 or 3 years in, you know, in hospitality, I thought for sure we were going to see a huge surge in the craft beer space as well. And we never really did. I mean, there were pockets. There was, you know, Creature Comforts down in Athens, Georgia that tried to organize. They lost their election. There were a couple of other breweries around the country that tried to organize. In one case, they shut the, you know, they shut the brewery down rather than face the union. There was here in Cleveland a number of years ago, Great Lakes Brewery, which is one of the big kind of the granddaddy of craft beer here in Ohio. Their employees signaled that they wanted to organize, and that kind of died out. I had heard that the company, when the employees started talking about forming a union and a Facebook group went live, you know, let's organize Great Lakes. The company kind of found out what the employees wanted and just gave it to them. They wanted like raises and better benefits, and the company gave it to them, and that kind of shut that down. Great Lakes drivers just filed a petition. So while the brewery and the taproom employees remain non-union, their truck drivers just filed a petition to organize. So that's just started this week here in Northeast Ohio. But by and large, the beer industry itself on the organizing front has been really, really, really quiet. And it's really surprised me given the age and the activism of the type of people that will typically work in a brewery and in a tap room. It has surprised me that the enthusiasm that led 500 Starbucks stores to organize has not spilled over.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So that does it for beer. Although it is Friday and it'll be 5 o'clock in a few hours. So we'll see what happens later. You mentioned your blog earlier. You've been a blogger for a long time, won some recognition, and it's something that you do almost every day. But one of the big things that you do each year, and it's funny, I'm going to tell you a little story about this question in a second, is the worst employers list that you create throughout the year. One of our mutual acquaintances, we were in a chat group, a text chat, and I shared something that you posted, and this other individual that Phil and I know kind of was like, yeah, well, that's going to get him in trouble in his law practice. And, you know, kind of calling out an employer, you know, sort of like an HR guy who didn't really like to see a labor lawyer calling out an employer. So when we started talking about doing this show with you, Phil said, we should ask you a real deep meta question and start out with, why do you do this? Why do you create the worst employer list? And what's the story behind it?
I should say it's like one of my, you post amazing stuff like all the time, but some of my favorite stuff you do is the worst employer. Like I think it's brilliant, but go ahead.
I would question the bona fides of any HR person who would try and defend the actions of anyone that appears on that list. I mean, it's really awful, awful, awful stuff. I mean, Monday, the next nominee is going live on Monday. I think it's the 7th or 8th for this year. And it is an employer that had a wage and hour complaint. A restaurant, their employees file a wage and hour complaint over management kind of taking money out of the tip pool. And among other things, like threatening to have workers deported. And one of the owners of the business goes, finds out where one of the employees is now working. The employee quits, goes to work for another restaurant, goes to his new place of business and threatens to kill him if he continues to help the DOL in their investigation. I mean, this is like indefensible stuff. But the reason why I do it is because I think people need to know and understand that there are lousy employers out there and that there are employers out there that have bad intentions. And if we don't call them out for their behavior, I think we're complicit in allowing this behavior to go unchallenged and unchecked. Mm-hmm. So I'm an advocate for employers, but in being an advocate for employers, I feel that I can do much more. I help employers more by helping them remain compliant within the bounds of the law than by defending when they do crappy things. Like, no good comes from someone defending someone going to someone's place of business saying, I'm going to kill you. Mm-hmm. Or someone, you know, using racist words one of the prior year's winners, someone not running a background check and finding out that someone was a convicted sex offender. And then that person goes and stalks and kills a female employee that he had taken a shine to. Like, nothing good comes from calling out or not calling out that kind of behavior. We should call it out. We should hold people accountable for it. It's horrible. I mean, if you appear on my list, you've done something really, really, really wrong. Mm-hmm. that you should be called out for. So yeah, I'm an advocate for employers, but I'm doing my job for employers by maintaining that list every year. It's also really fun to do, and it's fun to, you know, especially when you get to December and people vote on it. And I mean, it's fun to see how it shakes out and the psychology of what people think of as kind of degrees of awful. Like, this, I find the psychology of that really interesting. But we should, as employers, as HR people, as advocates for employers, we should support that kind of behavior being called what it is, which is just awful and indefensible.
Yeah. And, you know, the union side likes to, like, particularly us, and I assume you get a lot of this too, you know, sort of bash us as like we're protecting these like horrible employers when nothing could be further from the truth, right? Like, our mission in life and what gets me and gets Michael and the rest of our bunch out of bed in the morning is helping our clients create extraordinary workplaces. Like, that's what we are all about. And yeah, occasionally there are terrible employers that cross our path because, you know, a union campaign has started because they were treating people like crap. And that, you know, is a moment where we actually have a ton of leverage to help create a great workplace, because it's like, look, you deserve exactly what's happening to you. And you have two options here. You're either going to be like bargaining with the union. And frankly, if you're not going to change your ways, like, that's the best thing that could happen to this group of employees, or you're going to fix this. Like, you're going to start leading in a way that makes people want to deal directly with you and want to work with you. And like, it's one of those two options. But we're not like, you know, you are not doing this. And we certainly are not going around going like, okay, well, let's figure out like how you can keep, you know, being a horrible employer.
Like, yeah. No one is advocating for like how to steal from your employees or how to discriminate against your employees or how to retaliate against your employees. That's horrible and it's indefensible. And if that's the kind of business you operate, yeah, you will get the union you deserve, period. Yeah. And you probably need that union to protect your workers because you're not doing it for them.
Or better yet, just go out of business. Like those companies should get damage awards like so ridiculous that they are bankrupt. Like that, you know, the people that make it on your list should not be employing people. Like, that's just all that there is to it.
Yeah, I will say that it, you know, there are lots of years where the people that have won my list, if I actually had a trophy that I was going to send out, I would have to have sent it to a federal penitentiary.
Right.
So oftentimes they do get what they deserve. So,
yeah. So one of the least egregious ones, John, was a couple of years ago, an employer in Florida, I think in the Tampa area, invited her employees to come to work and bring their families during a hurricane so that they could continue to put out the product inside their very safe warehouse or whatever it was. And
keep working through the hurricane. Yeah. I mean, there are degrees of awful. There was the employer that, an employee complained about how he was getting paid. So then quit his job and the employer gave him his last paycheck in a sack full of pennies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, don't do that, but that's funny, right? The you didn't background check the sex offender and someone ended up getting murdered is just heartbreaking. And then there's all kind of shades in between. So
it does your list does get attention and it does call out behaviors and reminds HR people, I think, in a very fun and noticeable way about like how you should be doing the right thing. So I can certainly see that. Get ready to wrap up. So we always close with some personal stuff. So I know this has been a big summer for your daughter. I saw the week of Nora. I was thinking it might be more a couple months of Nora, but
more whatever. Like the year of. Mm-hmm. So I have two kids. So my daughter just turned 18, just graduated high school, and then my son is about to turn 16. She's a musician. He plays soccer. They're both awesome kids, but in the span of a couple of weeks, she opened for her old friend, Rhett Miller, the lead singer of the old 97s. She's a musician. She turned 18, got her driver's license, graduated high school. So it was a big couple weeks for her. And, she had a, without getting into detail, she had a really rough start to her senior year. And so it was really cool as a parent to kind of see her work through that, get through that, and then turn it around and finish her year the way she finished it and have all this, the good things she deserves. So it as a dad, it made me feel really good. And I'm not ashamed to say that the tears started Wednesday of graduation week with senior banquet. And part of senior banquet is the parents, if they want, can give a little speech. That's when the tears started, and they didn't stop till sometime after graduation Saturday afternoon. So it was a good few days.
Tell us real quick the short version of the Rhett Miller story, because I just think that's amazing.
So my daughter has been a musician since she was 7. And started in the local School of Rock program. And the very first show she did at School of Rock, she did a song, an old 97 song called The New Kid. And she was 7 with her little kind of 3/4 size Fender Squire guitar, playing these little root notes and singing the song. And it was adorable. So I threw it up on Facebook after the show was over. And the band liked it. Rhett Miller liked it. He kind of shared it on his page about how cool it was. So now flash forward a few months, the old 97s are in town. This is 2014. The old 97s are in town on tour promoting their new album. And as it turns out, the general manager of the School of Rock that my daughter went to, in his prior life, he was a label rep at Elektra Records, which was when the old 97s were on a major label back in the 90s. That was their label. And so he sort of kind of knew them back from his days at Elektra, but still knew people who knew them and their management. So he got us backstage before the show, and Nora got to meet Rhett. And they developed this little kind of friendship over the years. And he had her up on stage to sing with him twice. Over the years when he came through Cleveland solo. But more to the point, when we went backstage that first time and met him, she had just turned 8. And he told her that when she was a working musician, kind of making money playing her own gigs, that she could open for him. And so when he announced his show here in Cleveland a few months ago, she messaged him and said, "Hey, you know, remember when you told me this? And I would love the opportunity. And if it doesn't work out, I'll be there anyway, you know, in the audience, but I would love the opportunity to open for you." And he got back to her within like 5 minutes and was like, Yes. Here's my email. Send me, whatever promo material you want to send me so I can give it to my management to look at. And we'll, if we can make it happen, we'll make it happen. And so it happened. Then it was awesome.
Yeah. Super cool.
Yeah. He's a genuinely nice guy.
Yeah. We got to get you to Tulsa the next time, the old 97s, they'll play Kane's Ballroom, which is,
Kane's was on my list of places I want to see a show anyway. So
yeah, have to do that.
We saw Wilco there last year. That was the only time I've been there. It was really cool. Yeah. So we're running over. So you're headed to the Azores?
The Azores, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
The Azores. I'm not sure. I'll let you know in a few weeks when I get back where the accent actually goes.
Yeah. Don't step on any pit vipers. My brief research said that they have pit vipers there. But it sounds like everything else is wonderful.
That's really good advice for anywhere, though, Michael.
Yeah, that's sound advice for any vacation. Avoid the poisonous snakes. Yeah. John
asked on Threads or Facebook, what should I see? And I looked, and it's first thing it mentioned was some professor who has been walking around in pit viper nests trying not to get bitten. I'm like, yeah, don't do that.
So. Apparently the time of year we're going is big for the Portuguese man of war jellyfish. And I've seen photos from like the summer where there's like thousands of them that wash up on the beach. So
there's a bunch of those guys.
I have been stung by one and I do not recommend it.
So we may not, I guess they've put flags up in on the beaches when they're around. So we're going to keep an eye out and try to avoid them. Yeah. As best as possible.
Yeah.
So we'll wish you bon voyage or whatever the Portuguese equivalent.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. My Portuguese is limited to, hello, goodbye, thank you. And maybe ordering a glass of wine and maybe asking where the bathroom is, which I think are the five most important things you need to know how to say when you go to a foreign country. So
exactly.
Just take your phone and chat GPT. They'll translate for you. No problem.
That's exactly right.
Have a safe trip, man. And thanks for doing the show today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's always good to see you guys.
Yeah, it was great. We'll do it again
next time.
We'll see you
next time at Kane's Ballroom.
All right. There you go. We will do that. All right.